we appreciate, first of all, you all coming here today. As you all have witnessed over the last few weeks, as the drought intensifies, the critics of the renewable fuel standard continue to try to blame our industry and want to open up the RFS. Bob Dineen and I thought that as representatives of the ethanol industry, it would be really great to get some facts out there that often get overlooked. Many times misinformation gets finds its way over and over into the stories and into the criticism. And we thought, number one, we wanted to straighten out some of that information. Two, show the and discuss the impact that's occurring or not occurring. Three, certainly talk about the flexibility already built into the RFS and other measures. So, first of all, did we just push the arrow? The RFS is clearly under attack, the renewable fuel standard. And it's really a shame that the critics are trying to take the drought and turn it around and blame ethanol for it. You know, there's probably no one suffering more in this drought than the grain farmers, who will definitely see a reduced crop. No one knows how big a reduction that's going to be, because no one knows what the weather's going to do between now and actual harvest. But they're blaming the grain farmers, or basically taking the grain farmers who are already suffering from a reduced crop, and now saying, let's take away part of their demand so they can have even lower prices, which doesn't make, number one, a lot of sense, having been a former farmer and a landowner, and I've raised livestock as well as grain. That seems to be a short-sighted approach in a very serious time for many people in rural America. How serious is the drought? Again, no one knows. I guess it would be analogous to a political poll and 3 months out before the election. It may be a snapshot. It may be based on opinion. There's a lot that will happen over the next 3 months in determining the final crop, and the final crop is the one that counts. Just like in a political poll, there's only one poll that matters, and that's the one on election day. But it seems to be getting a lot of attention. The drought's not like other natural disasters, which have impacted key segments and key industries, the hurricanes with the refineries, floods with the transportation, and even more recently the tsunamis that hit in Japan caused a lot of economic disruptions. But I think what you have to keep in mind is the markets will help sort out the problem, and certainly production will increase when we do get some rain. So for next year, you know, I was always told when I was farming, the best cure for high prices is high prices, which means the farm sector will respond to higher prices with even higher production. And that's always been a natural in the agriculture industry. And our nation's farmers certainly have the capacity to produce. In fact, they normally they overproduce, and I think you'll see that very nearly in the future. Some of the critics put out a lot of false claims, and the first one is one that I see repeatedly in stories. And I don't know why people don't want to give us credit in the ethanol process. The only thing we remove from that kernel of corn is the starch. All the protein, fiber, and oil comes back in an animal feed, a very high protein, high quality, most of the times less expensive feed for livestock and poultry. And so that 40% number is way overstated. That's the gross amount, not the net amount of corn used. And it makes it sound like we're using a lot more than we actually are. And let me briefly run through a couple more things, and I've got a great slide on that one. Another false claim out there is we're going to run out of corn. We've never run out of corn. You don't run out of commodities. Do you run out of cheap commodities? Do prices change? Of course they do, but the markets sort that out, and Bob's going to go through that extensively here. Another false claim. Even one story this week said food prices are skyrocketing. No, they're not skyrocketing. The drought's impact has not even been felt into the marketplace yet. And in fact, General Mills' CEO was quoted in the media as saying he estimates that food prices would only go up 2 to 3% next year. So, and they went up even more than that the previous year. So he's not talking like the sky is going to fall on food prices. The amount of commodities and the commodities' role in the final food dollar is minimal. Most food costs are probably attributable to energy. The cost of transportation, the cost of processing, the cost of storage, distribution, wrapping is a far greater cost than the raw commodity. USDA's projections were 3 to 4%. So, again, the sky isn't falling. Food versus fuel. Everybody's saying, oh, my gosh, now we got that food versus fuel issue again. Well, I've been in Washington for 25 years. And I've heard some whoppers in this town, but I've never heard a bigger whopper than the food versus fuel because people don't bother to check the facts. We make ethanol primarily out of corn. The only thing we remove, again, is the starch. We return one-third of the crop in volume back in an animal feed. Ethanol from corn is made from number 2 yellow corn. Animal feed is its primary and overwhelming use over and over. Our co-product is animal feed. It's not canned corn, sweet corn, popcorn, or even candy corn that we make this stuff out of. It's number 2 yellow corn. And the fourth false claim is the only recourse is to waive the RFS. Bob's going to address that. That's not the resolution. Let me go to this slide. And the 40% of the crop goes to ethanol. And this slide was put together by Monsanto. But if you look at the total corn acreage, this was 2010, 2011. It's up considerably this year. 88 million acres. The gross number of corn acres used for ethanol are 32 million, 32.6. When you add back in this co-product called distillers' grains, that's the equivalent of 9.4 million acres returned to the feed source. And when you take the replacement value that is provided by the distillers' grains, because it's high in protein, it's got all the nutrients that you want, it displaces soybean meal. And so you gain another 8.7 million acres of displacing soybean acres when you correct it for that. So the net corn ethanol acreage is 14.5 out of 88 in 2011, be somewhat similar for this year. And if you follow down below there, the net acre determination, acre corn for ethanol, the distiller's grains there in the middle, the offset for what goes back into the distiller's grain for feed, and the offset for what replaces soybeans. And what you end up with is not 40%. What you end up with is 16% of the net corn acres are used for ethanol. And, you know, again, the most frustrating part of these debates is not debating the facts, but it's debating misinformation. And if you get nothing else out of this today, I hope you at least explore it. If you, you know, if you want further information, Bob or I can provide it to you. As others. But you see in the pie chart down there, 50% goes for U.S. feeds with the distiller's grains. The net ethanol mark is, percentage is down there, that small, smaller green one on the lower right. And then, of course, you got your carryout. Let me back up here a second. The other thing that people miss in this debate, or what are the benefits of ethanol? All we hear about the negatives. Well, we're 10% of our nation's gasoline supply. And if you remove that 10% of the gasoline supply, what's going to happen to gasoline prices? They're going to skyrocket. Look at what happened when we've had the oil disruptions in the Middle East recently with Libya and others, even when the Suez Canal was under threat of closure in Egypt. We see this gigantic spike in gasoline prices. And you have to keep in mind that every recession this country has had in the last 40 years has been preceded by high gasoline prices. In fact, even the high gas prices this past year have stalled our economic recovery from one of the biggest economic disasters and downturns our country's ever seen. We provide up to 400,000 direct and indirect jobs because of ethanol production, GDP around $50 billion. We're better for the environment, less greenhouse gas emissions, consumer savings at the pump, anywhere from, and you can get a range here anywhere from 25 cents a gallon to $1.09, I think, a gallon. We reduce dependence on foreign oil and national security. Those are all really, really important things to consider. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to my colleague, Bob Dineen, CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association.
Thank you, Tom, and thanks all of you for being here and allowing us to answer some questions about this program. Obviously, this has become a lightning rod on Capitol Hill, and we hope to be able to provide a little bit of perspective. Some of the perspective that I bring to this debate is the fact that the Renewable Fuels Association, and myself specifically, was very much involved in the development of the Renewable Fuels Program in 2005 and in 2007. And one of the things that we tried to do in both instances was to build a lot of flexibility into this program, because refiners were concerned that marketplace anomalies like what we're seeing today could occur, and they might not have access to the ethanol that they would need. So in both instances, the act that was passed incorporated provisions that provide those refiners with a great deal of flexibility. First, there's a credit trading mechanism that is utilized so that refiners could build up credits to be used when they need them later on. They could trade those credits with refiners that may not be in a position to meet their obligation. And so we were required as ethanol producers, with every gallon we produce, we also provide the refiners with what's called a renewable identification number, or a RIN. And a RIN is just a gallon of ethanol that has been produced but may not have been used for compliance yet. There are 2.5 billion RINs in the marketplace today. That builds a lot of flexibility into this program and can allow refiners to meet their obligation without having to blend wet gallons. Another important provision is refiners would be allowed to carry over their obligation for a year. And so if there's not enough ethanol for them to meet their obligation this year, they can carry forward a certain amount to meet next year. And then there was, of course, the waiver provision. But the waiver provision is based on the supply of ethanol and the ability of the refiners to meet their obligation. And clearly, there is more than enough ethanol supply, additional RINs in the marketplace, and flexibility for refiners to meet their obligation this year. It is not going to be an issue. The marketplace itself, though, has provided additional flexibility because we have been overproducing. There is now, in fact, 800 million gallons of ethanol supply in the marketplace that could be used if there's not enough supply being produced day to day. Today, the marketplace is, in fact, utilizing that flexibility. You see, with this chart, the ethanol industry has, in fact, responded to the market signal that it has received. And since June 8th, when we first started seeing reports of a stressed crop out there and the drought became apparent to folks, we have reduced our supply by 14%. Now, there are some other users of grain that have actually increased their corn demand in that time. Export inspections are up over the last month. There is some data that would suggest that eggs and poultry and pork are also increasing their corn utilization over this period. We are a very responsive market, and our producers have been slowing production. There are now 25 plants that aren't in operation, and there are a number of other plants that have slowed their production considerably. This chart just shows ethanol production over the last 3 years and what has happened over the last month or so. You see at the end of that table, ethanol production absolutely fallen off like a cliff. But the first three lines represent what the renewable fuel requirement was for refiners during each of those years. And you can see ethanol production has always been far above what was required. That's how they're generating RINs. That's how there's credits in this marketplace that can be relied upon now. So as we fall below for the very first time the required gallons that are needed, they've got RINs that they can use. 2.5 billion RINs on the marketplace today. This gives you a sense of the stocks that are out there. The red dots represent what would be a 20-day supply, but you've seen over the past couple of years, we've had an extraordinary amount of excess supply in the marketplace. And in fact, when you look at late 2010, we were at historic levels for ethanol supply. We're now starting to come down some as those stocks are drawn upon, reflecting the flexibility in this marketplace. I would note that just for comparison purposes, historically, the oil industry operates on a just-in-time inventory, and they just have about 2 days' worth of supply throughout the system. That's why anytime there's a pipeline break or some sort of a disruption in their production or distribution, prices spike considerably. Our industry is in a situation where we've got a great deal of supply in the marketplace to deal with some of those situations. What we tried to do was evaluate various scenarios, and you'll have a copy of this, and you can look at it at greater length, but we walked through a high scenario for production, which would be if we continued producing at the rate that we were producing the first 6 months of the year, and what that would mean for production, what that would mean for corn use. But looking at just the eight-week average, you see that production falls off 4.2%. If you extended it to the average production over the past 4 weeks, would be down 8.8%. And then we looked at a medium low and a very low situation where if you looked at just the last week's average production, we would be down 20% versus where we were at the beginning of the year. So you see a dramatic reduction in production. Now, you extend that, and you see what the production would be with each of those scenarios. It would range from 13.7 billion gallons, which is really where we anticipated at the beginning of the year, to maybe as low as 12.5 billion gallons if we continue to run at the rate that we've been running in the last week. Exports will be a factor here as well. So far this year, we have exported about 350 million gallons. That's gone. But if we continue to export at the rate that we were at the beginning of the year, you can anticipate 650 to 700 million gallons exported. That's not happening. Already we've seen the export markets fall off demonstrably as well. And, you know, our estimate could be it might fall down to as much as 400 million gallons or so for the entire year. But there again, the marketplace is responding as demand is falling. The RVO for 2012 actually gives me an opportunity to explain the way this program works in a little bit more detail. Because while the actual RFS statutory demand for ethanol this year was 13.2 billion gallons, EPA a year ago had to evaluate how much demand for gasoline there would actually be and translate that into a percentage of ethanol to be required per gallon or for each refiner. Gasoline demand has fallen off considerably this year. And so while EPA had anticipated that the percentage that they utilized, which was 9.73, I believe, for each refiner, that 9.73 percentage that the refiners have to blend now only represents about 13 billion gallons of fuel, so 200 million gallons less than what we were expected the demand to be at the beginning of the year. 200 million gallons doesn't seem like much, but believe me, in this context, it's an important factor. So the RFS required volumes are less than the statute envisioned, simply because once the EPA determined the percentage, as gasoline demand has fallen, so has the demand for the ethanol requirement, their obligation. This chart also goes through then how many RINs would be needed to make up for the reduction in supply. And you see, even in our very low production scenario, where we are reducing ethanol production by 20% versus the beginning of the year, only 890 million RINs would be necessary for refiners to continue to meet their obligation. And again, the waiver's about their obligation. We've got 2.5 billion RINs. So conceivably, if the market signal of dissent is that refiners are going to want to blend less ethanol, utilize more of the RINs, utilize more of the stocks, that could fall even further. We've got a fair amount we can continue to fall without having to produce, and refiners could still meet their obligation. And then that translates into, in the bottom line there, the corn equivalent bushels. And it could be that there'd be more than 320 million bushels available, given the low production scenario that we could see. The bottom line is this. The RFS is about refiners being able to meet their obligation. Refiners can meet their obligation because of the flexibility built into this program, because of excess RINs, because of excess supply, because of other flexibility built into the program that would allow them to roll over their requirements. So, ethanol producers have responded very quickly to the market signal that's been given. We've reduced our production. We might reduce our production even more. But there's no reason to waive this program. You'd just be rewarding refiners when they can meet their obligation in any case. The marketplace will ultimately figure out how to ration demand. Already, we are rationing demand. It's really important to let this program continue to operate as it was designed, with the flexibility designed into the program, and not take precipitous action to undermine this very important energy security program that Tom talked about.